Welcome today to an interview series with Astounding Professionals. I'm Stephen Ibraki, and I'm conducting an exclusive interview with Damon Vickers, Chief Investment Officer, world-renowned investment authority, best-selling author, The Day After the Dollar Crashes. Damon, thank you for coming in today to share your deep experiences with our audience.
Nice. Thank you for inviting me.
Damon, you have this remarkable profile, and you've got this just tremendous book. Can you profile some key roles and events in your life?
Key roles and events in my life? I'm not sure of the question.
Oh, anything that you would say that are notable in your past that you've done that you want to share with the audience, perhaps some lessons that you've learned?
Well, I probably had a kind of a varied background. You know, my family, very affluent family, deeply connected family, and this country's history, and, you know, my great-grandmother founded the Culinary Institute of America, the largest cooking school and most respected cooking school in America, and my great-grandfather ran the Rockefeller Foundation and also the Carnegie Foundation, and also was a president of Yale University. He also brought in Harvard-type education, not a Harvard, the Oxford-type education into America. That was James Angel. That was my great-grandfather. My great-great-grandfather invented air conditioning and khaki material, and which was the all the uniforms and clothes that the Army and all the our military forces used during the Second World War and Korea and Vietnam. My father was a floor trader, Goldman Sachs. My other grandfather worked at another investment firm as well. So my family, kind of prominent, very connected. Good relationships, good deep relationships with you know, some of the people, I guess, shaping public policy and for the country and the world for a good number of years. How did that shape me? I mean, I think it was certainly interesting being a son, being a grandson, a great grandson of that family's history and that lineage. But my father gave a lot of that up. You know, he left Wall Street. He left Goldman Sachs when I was a child. And, you know, I had a very different childhood. So I, as a child, I learned to adapt because my life as a child was full of contrasts. You know, on the one hand, the experience with my mother's family and then the experience with my father, who had basically given up, you know, given up a lot of the Western pursuits of the accumulation of wealth and all of those things. So, you know, as a child, I suppose I learned to adapt. I had the benefit, I think, of the values of and the experience of my great-grandmother and her father and my great-grandfather, who, even though I never met, his belief and his values were certainly conveyed in our family and that of my great-great-grandmother. And that is of service to the world, and service to humanity.
That's quite a remarkable background and sort of a life experience is engaging with such a deep, rich history. So I can see how that kind of influences different parts of what you do today. Now, you are this recognized global expert. So what would you say, I would say, would be the five notable trends that people should be aware of?
Well, there's, you know, five trends. How do we pick five trends? I don't know that there's five. I don't know that there's ten. I don't know that there's three. But I guess I'll maybe pick a couple of things that I think are kind of significant. I think some of the biggest things that are facing us right now is this kind of relationship between government and people. And I think government it needs to quickly kind of assess its relationship to the general population of the world. And because the people of the world are increasingly, their power is growing, and it's growing faster than government's ability to control them, which puts governments in kind of a fearful state because government wants to perpetuate itself. So I think government kind of has to be aware of that. And in the United States, and in the West in particular, the difficulty is the growth of the state, And the fact that the state is principally run by, you know, by the unions and by the teachers and the firemen and the police and all of that. And they, the elected officials in the United States and state government and also in Western Europe, those power structures are continually elected by the unions, and the unions just vote in tons of, they vote in people that shower them with bennies, which, you know, higher cost of living, higher pensions, higher, you know, wages, more benefits, blah, 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 blah. So the politician showers its electorate, which is not the general population. The politicians shower the unions and their supporters, which is basically the government infrastructure. So government is basically feeding, sustaining itself for its own purpose, not the service of society that it's supposedly representing. So how does that inevitably work itself out? Well, I think inevitably it works itself out as a rejection of government itself. And you've seen this in the Middle East, in the Arab Spring. You've seen it increasingly in Greece and the like, and that we're going to have massive change, you know, really upheaval of power structures. I know China is viewed, at least in this country, is viewed as an authoritarian state. Yet I think when we look at ourselves and we look at the United States, if we're willing to do so, which may be brave in and of itself, the United States is also kind of authoritarian a little bit. You know, we have the biggest prison populations in the planet. We have, you know, really a very authoritarian structure, you know, and so my hope is that as we move forward in time, we may find common ground with all cultures, and all people and all religion and all thoughts and ideas, and varied expression is respected and preserved for the purpose of the sustainability of our world, that variance is very important. And when a government, whether it's the Chinese or the United States or anybody, subjects the and eliminates variety or differences by making everybody conform, this is not the essence of nature. It's the essence of nature for variance. If we were to walk into a jungle or a forest, we would see all kinds of different trees, all kinds of different flowers, all kinds of different species, all kinds of different things. And this is a reflection of the world. This is the true nature of nature itself, because some things will work and some things will not work. But it is not up for any one of us to play God or play the master of the universe to pick winners and losers. Winners and losers are chosen automatically. They're chosen naturally. But it's good, because occasionally with variance, you get a Leonardo da Vinci. Occasionally with variance, you get a Confucius. Occasionally with variance, you get a Buddha, a Jesus, a Gandhi, a something like that. So it's very, very important to do that and to allow the freedom of expression and thought so that the whole world is moved forward and that we all evolve and that we have culture and that we have variety. This is very, very important. But in terms of governments, if they don't adapt and change, the global population will usurp the power of much of the current government structure globally, and governments will not have as much meaning anymore. My hope further too is that we can see a time when individual nationality is not so important, and we have more, I would say, honor to that of the world, and that I could have as much love for a child in China as my own, and a person in China could love my child as much as their own. For we're all related. We're all of the same family. We have much more in common with our own, with even our own DNA, that we are all cousins. We are all related. We are all a part of the same family. There is no need and no purpose is served by dividing the world into nationalities and political structures and power structures that pit us against one another. Because I love the Chinese, and I love the French, and I love the Germans, and I love the Tibetans, and I love the Greeks, and I love the Spanish, and I love the Canadians, and I love the little children of Bora Bora, all the same.
Those are really interesting views, and I'm sure they'll create or generate a lot of discussion. So politically, would you say you're left of center, right of center, center?
Well, I don't know. I I mean, as I said, I think inevitably, I don't think that governments, much of the global government structures, are going to survive. I think that the power is very, very, very quickly shifting to that of the population. Government thinks it has control, but it actually doesn't. The people have control. And to the extent that the governments continue to work against the welfare of the general population, they're even counting their numbers down even faster. In the United States, you know, we've had this, the quote democratic, the concept of democracy, the concept of everybody getting together, weighing in on their opinions, having free expression of thought, and coming up with a consensus. This is a valuable concept. In practice, though, it's not working very well. Democracy on a global basis is failing. It's interesting that we look at Greece, and Greece is known as really the cradle, the beginning of democracy, and Greece is failing. I could see that coming out of Greece, we have a fascist government, which would be a further distortion. But the concept of democracy is a beautiful concept. In practice, democracy has been co-opted by the government itself. The government itself, the institution itself, in the United States, in Western Europe, the democratic governments of these areas are failing. So you asked me about my political aspirations. We are in the United States really moved very, very far left. And we've engendered a society where a lot of people are not motivated to produce, create, invent, or even dream because they've been put to sleep by the wrong messages and the wrong ideas. And so, you know, I'm probably moving a little bit more conservative at this time as a counter to what is going on in the United States on a state level. So I'm probably leaning more, you know, Republican, if there's such a thing at this time. But in the end of the day, both Democrat and Republican are just another fantasy. My view of what I'd like to see in terms of a world government doesn't have either.
You know, that's fascinating in your discussion about sort of the disappearance of boundaries, and they could be corporate boundaries perhaps, or even geographical country boundaries. And I would imagine social media has something to do with that, you know, like you see with the Arab Spring and so on. Mm-hmm. So if we would extend into a question then, what do you see as some of the key disruptive forces that are out there and why?
Well, certainly social networking, I think, is very helpful for people. You know, they get in touch with one another. The trend of collapsing barriers, the trend of collapsing borders is a very good trend. There really aren't the boundaries and borders that there used to be. It's why increasingly large segments of the world, even though we have all these nuclear weapons, and the United States has tons of nuclear weapons, and China has nuclear weapons, and Russia has nuclear weapons, that I think the more enlightened minds of the world really kind of really wonder, well, you know, I don't think we see ourselves on a more enlightened upper level. We don't see ourselves as so separate. You know, we do business with the Chinese, and the Chinese are good servants to the United States, and give us valuable things, and they put a lot of quality into the things that they make for us. Very good work, and very good quality, and very good care, and a good work ethic. Where the boundaries of the world are dissolving, and the boundaries of the world should dissolve, for I would like to see a world, and I hope that we see a world, without borders, without boundaries, without governments. Religion, important to allow people to express themselves, even though much of the world's religions are creative at best. But people need to find meaning for their lives. They need to find meaning for their place in the universe. And so that those views are also developing. And what the world needs right now is the world needs a new message. That's what the world needs. The world needs a new message, a new belief system that can be embraced globally by all people and all people at the same time. And in so doing, they begin to share a heritage. They begin to share a new culture, a new definition for themselves, not as people that are separate, but people that are one.
Perhaps you've already touched upon this, Ben. What do you see as the top opportunities that are out there that people can engage in?
Opportunities in what context?
It could be in from a business context, but also maybe from a social context.
Well, from a business context, business is good. Profits are good. Wealth is good. When a squirrel walks in the woods, he thinks not that there is a pile of acorns and he should be guilty for taking the pile of acorns. Yet there's much religion in the world that says that if you have too many acorns, this is a good thing. Acorns are just acorns. Money is just money. And there's lots of it, and there's little of it, and there's as much of it as you want. The world is a funny place. And the world is a funny place because you basically, everybody kind of gets what they want. People have a funny way of like a thermostat, controlling the happiness and sadness, or the amount of wealth, or the amount of lack of wealth that they have. Everyone kind of is in control of their own thermostat. And I know there are outliers, meaning there are some people that actually have no control of their thermostat, but I'm not sure that's entirely true either, because what we think and our perceptions become, they become the world around us. If for opportunities, I'm not sure with the question, opportunities on a business sense, and what was the other question? Opportunities on a what?
Perhaps on a social sense as well.
Social sense. The opportunity on a social sense is a really big one. It's the one we've all been waiting for. The opportunity on a social sense is that we have the possibility, we have enough enlightenment, enough knowledge, we have enough to know that the type of world that we'd like to see is possible, and that it is possible in our lifetime. And that is a world of peace, a world of harmony, a world of kindness, a world of compassion, not just from, you know, man to man, but man to all life. We all share this planet, and we share our universe. And it's very, and I don't say this in a touchy-feely, you know, pastel color, you know, fantastic, but really, we have imminently, right in front of us, the possibility to create a world where we get along. Where not only do we get along, but that there's peace, prosperity, and a renaissance of all life. But this must come from respect. We must respect one another. We must value. And an essential of all truth is the value of differences. I must value the fact that I must value the Chinese. I must value their culture. I must value their history. I must value their tremendous arts and their tremendous architecture. I must value their work ethic, their love for their children, the incredible variety and history of their food, of all things. And China must also begin to value perhaps its own cultural tribes for its own future, which is the Tibetan people, which is some of the Mongolian tribe. All tribes must be respected. It would be a very, very sad thing that in this race for Western technology, for Gucci handbags, for Coach purses, that all of that is like junk food. All of that is transient. It has no enduring value. We must do what we can to preserve cultural variance and natural variance. So the opportunity in front of us is an opportunity. And if we can do that, if I can respect a Muslim, a Christian, a Jew, a Buddhist, a Jehovah's Witness, a Confucianist, whatever variant, just as I can respect a person who's Chinese, who may be black, who may be white, who may be French, who may be African, all variety of life must be respected, and not just man, but all variety of life of all living things. And the other opportunity right in front of us is to really own up and acknowledge the fact that there is consciousness in all life. That when you go and you scratch the underside of your dog's neck or your cat and they purr, or they want you to know that they're feeling happy, that they enjoy the fact that you're giving them kindness. You know that with a horse. You know that with all kinds of animals. For us to continue to live under the, to fool ourselves that there is not consciousness in life, in all life, in the birds, in the fishes, and all the, is mistaken. And it's very easy when we have supermarkets and the like to cut, to dice and slice our fellow creatures because they don't look so much like they did before. They're in plastic now. But to the extent that we can expand our heart, to the extent that we can expand our compassion for all living things, not only do we bring salvation to them, but in so doing, we also bring salvation to ourselves.
You know, embedded in this sort of discussion that we've had so far, I can see areas of controversy, or perhaps they would be thought of as areas of controversy. Sort of looking at it from a more of an external point of view and looking at the world around us, outside of the ideas that you already talked about, what do you see as three major areas of controversy that we should be engaged in?
That's a funny question. What do you mean? What areas of controversy?
It could be political, it could be religious, it could be corporate, just in your mind, maybe three things that you see out there and you think, wow, that's a controversial area, and here are my thoughts.
Well, it's controversial, yeah. Well, I mean, I'm definitely aware of the fact that it's that a couple of things that I'm saying are somewhat controversial. The idea of creating one world as viewed as being something that some people are afraid of because they wonder, well, okay, I can theorize peace, right? You know, I know there's some people, well, there's a heaven, and they think that heaven someday, they're going to be in heaven. And I don't think people, when they think of heaven, and many religions have a version of heaven, not all, but many, I don't think that they really perceive all this separateness. This version of heaven. Are there like borders? Do people have guns pointing at each other? Are they rounding up their fellow creatures and dicing and slicing and slaughtering them and bleeding them out, hitting them overhead with clubs? Is that what heaven looks like? I don't think so. So we can create any world that we want. Start from the end in mind. Nobody knows, well, I don't know how to get there. You know, okay. Well, a long journey begins with a single step. But the most effective process is to focus on what is the end game. What are you looking for? What could be the ultimate best possibility for the planet? And then go backward. The best possibility for the planet is that we don't have separate governmental structures. Because we're pitting against all this effort of militarization and nationalities that pit us against one another is not purposeful. It's not good. It's a waste of time and it's a waste of life. And it's not good. It's not good for the casualties, which is all the people that get killed in all these wars. It's not good. So that's kind of a controversial concept. The concept of deciding that you're going to stop slaughtering fish and animals for the purpose of your diet or immediate gratification of your taste buds. That's a hard one to fight, I suppose. And yet we know, everybody knows, we know, but we're in denial about the fact that what we are doing is hurting our fellow travelers. We're in the same boat. The boat's our planet. We all live here together. We all have a history. On a greater sense, as I said, all our DNA is connected. That little fish, that little dog, they were on a longer strand of genetic material, these are our cousins. So that has to stop. That's a controversial thing to say. But it does need to stop. You know, in the United States, they're thinking about going into Bristol Bay. And north of Bristol Bay, this is up in Alaska. And what you have is one of the largest copper and gold discoveries of the last 100 years. Something like $200 to $500 billion of metal is in the ground. To do it, though, to get the metal out of the ground, it is in the headwaters of the very home to where the creation of all the Bristol Bay salmon fishery is. The Bristol Bay salmon fishery is the biggest salmon fishery on the planet. There's no other one after that. Most of the salmon stocks in the United States have been wiped out by greed. in a type of fish and fishing practice where they scooped up all the salmon right before they would run up the rivers. That's how the salmon stocks were depleted. That and deforestation, like cutting 2,000-year-old trees. This is a mistake because those salmon, they don't really just belong to the United States. That resource also belongs to the Chinese. It does. It's our planet. We share it together. We have to make decisions that are in defense of all of us, for the benefit of all of us. Not for the governmental interests, not for the corporate interests, but for the benefit of the people and the life. Life is valuable. Life is precious. But it's controversial to say, right? But it's the right thing to say. If someone needed to be there to say it, I'll say it. So, and that's really also what we need, is we need someone increasingly to be willing to step forward and to say the things that need to be said and to give the world the beginnings of a destination, and that they can begin on a good journey that has hope, because there's too much unfocused energy on a global basis right now. What we need is more unity, more common work.
You know, it's interesting. You're talking about sort of some of the social issues that have to be addressed and how that ties into humanity and, you know, having acceptance and sort of a unification of everything that's on the planet. Do you see technology playing a role in that in some way? You know, there's Ray Kurzweil, and he talks about a singularity where, you know, computers are going to evolve to the point where you're going to be able to download your consciousness into a computer, in fact, into a robot, perhaps, maybe within 30 years. Do you believe in all of that, or global?
Well, I don't know. I don't have any desire to download my consciousness into a robot. I was going to be doing an interview on CNBC today on high-frequency trading. We were trying to think of some analogies to high-frequency trading, and it's really, there was a flash crash a couple of years ago where in 20 minutes you had some issues, stock issues that went down like 90%. And these high-frequency traders, their argument is, we serve a purpose because we add more liquidity to the markets. Okay, that may or may not be so, but let's accept that. Then there's the other side of it, which is the general population, the investors, right? They really want to feel that if they buy and invest in a company and in a business and they're a shareholder, that their asset is not going to go down 90% in 10 minutes. And I think that's a valid thing to want, right? But you see, the enhanced liquidity of the machine versus the fact that people need to be able to, I think it's better for the markets that people don't feel that can happen. So I think you get more liquidity by the general participation of the individual. So the high frequency trading has got to be severely curtailed because it's totally out of control and nuts. And a lot of this is done by computers. So the bigger question is, you know, I would say, what is the real value of technology and its service to people, right? Technology is good. I like the ability that people that can leverage their time. It enables people to be more in contact with one another on some level. But on some levels, it doesn't enable people to be in contact with one another. I think particularly in families, that the home. Now, because you have a mother, you have a father, you have children. And when you have a lot of technology there, particularly young children, the young children are tending to involve themselves a lot in their technology and not in their relationships with their brothers and sisters. And parents have a lot of investment of their time in the technology and not as much investment of their time with their children. So I think that's, again, is a finding balance. Very, very important to find balance. But technology, I have no desire to download my consciousness into a machine, because there is the human heart and there is compassion. And this is something that a machine, as far as I know, is not capable of having. And a machine cannot necessarily conceptualize the universe, nor spirit, nor desire, nor faith, nor the power of manifest thinking, which is that our thoughts become things and our thoughts become reality. And so even the discussion that we're having right now is a step closer to the world that I'm discussing. And even as yet that I have verbalized, and these things are being verbalized right now in this conversation this morning, is another step towards seeing that happen on a global basis. It's simply because I verbalized it. This is something a machine cannot do. Still and as of yet, it is only thought and the power of thought that is able to create things and to be able to create a world and everything around us. For everything around us comes from the creation and the thoughts of our own mind.
Damon, you successfully predicted the internet bubble back in year 2000, the real estate bubble in year 2007, the financial crisis.
I did not predict. I did not predict. I made money from it. I guess I did predict. I mean, March 16th, 2000, I did say that it was over, and then we got short for the next 3 years, and the dot-com blow up. To predict would be, you know, was I saying it, you know, over and over again for the prior 2 years, oh, this can't be happening, it's coming, blah, 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 blah. No, I wasn't. Because in the years leading up to the 2000 dot-com meltdown, we were very long the market. We just simply changed course. We adapted. We flowed. We were fluid with change, which is what we do.
And I guess this applies to the real estate bubble in 2007, the financial crisis in 2008. And I guess the question then is, what kind of methodologies or processes do you use to have some idea or to prepare for some of these things that are happening?
Well, for me, it's a good preparation of my own mind. And the preparation of my own mind is to be kind of open, to be able to be a participant and to be a dancer, but also to be able to watch the dance, to be an actor, but to be able to watch the play, to be someone who drinks the coffee, but can also step out of themselves and see himself as the person drinking the coffee. It's very important to from an investment standpoint and from trying to manage change, which is essentially what we do, is that that's our business, that's what we do, is to kind of be able to step outside yourself. And so predicting, I'm not sure that predicting as much as I saw change, I see change, and I seek to position our money and our investments in the path of that change. And that's something that we've always done. And we did that with our investments in Starbucks Coffee. We did that with our investments in Amazon.com. We did that with our investments in, you know, Whole Foods Market, and we own Amazon and we own Whole Foods Market. And also, whether it be a bull market or a bear market, our goal is to seek to profit in whatever market is presented. You know, you might imagine that we're kind of like someone who surfs, or someone who surfing waves, or a person who sails a boat across the ocean and needs to change course every once in a while. But of course, you can drive down a road, and if you drove down a road and all you did was just steer the car straight, you would inevitably run out of road because a road will turn, and it's very important that you turn with it. The other thing is that from an investment standpoint, it's important to surrender very frequently, very important to surrender what you think you know. This one gets going to be objectification, stepping outside yourself, that it is better to try to align yourself with the will of the market and not your own will. And to not allow those two things to come into conflict. So I don't have a purpose per se from an investment standpoint other than to align myself with what's actually happening. To the extent that I am able to align myself with what is actually happening, then we have greater profit. It's only when I project my needs, my desires, that there can be conflict. But when I'm aligning myself with what's actually happening, I'm not. And so I came up with a prayer, which I delivered on TV in the United States last year. And the prayer was, and this is the traitor's prayer. It's not very religious. You don't need to go to church. You don't need to bow down or kneel or any type of giant ceremonies. But it's a very simple little phrase. It's may God, whatever God you choose, may God grant me the serenity to accept the will of the market and not mine own. And that's a good one. That's a good trader's prayer.
That's interesting. You're surrendering yourself to the universe and sort of how it's inclined to direct you rather than you directing the universe, it sounds.
Well, from an investment standpoint, I think that's very purposeful. From a global standpoint, what's actually required is someone to come forward and step forward and kind of begin to lead. This is the person we need. We need a person now to step forward. We need somebody to step forward and kind of lead and kind of bring a commonality to the planet. You can call this person whatever you want. You can call them a messiah. You can call them a leader. You can call them Gandhi. You can call them a whole bunch of foolish names, and none of it means anything. But the person is none of those things, and the person is just a person who is courageous enough to put forth a direction, because that's what's needed. The fact that everybody is kind of in protest and gathering, and the Occupy movements and the Arab Springs, people are gathering. People will continue to gather. The numbers will grow. The numbers are going to get very, very large. What they don't have is they don't have a direction. This is what is coming. Direction is coming.
So in this dialogue here, but also in your book, The Day After the Dollar Crashes, is that part of sort of your thrust, is to give a sense of direction to the people? And what are some of the other main objectives in writing the book?
Well, the book was written on comments that I had made in Asia about where we were in the West, and where the West was and where the United States was, and the tremendous debt, and that what will be needed is likely an alignment of global governments. It could go that way. You could have an alignment of global governments, and you could see some type of a new order, a new global order. Or we have things go in a more of a different way, which is, and I think better, which is that we have kind of an organic new world order coming from the respect of people and culture and all life. And that's the better one. That's the one that serves the interests of our children and our children's children and our children's 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 children. So that's much better. As I was writing the book, what I came to realize increasingly was that it's one thing to kind of see things and see kind of this change coming, but that also it was important to begin to articulate and to begin, just begin to articulate some ideas, to kind of assess how we got here, to begin to articulate some ideas, to begin putting forth some direction. And so in my humble, not so articulate way, I put some of those thoughts in the book, so that the world could just have the seed, to just have the beginning seed of what was possible. And so I'm happy that people have gathered. I'm happy to have seen the Occupy, and this is, I think, a good first step, but it is only really a first step. It's very important. It's a good thing that people come together, a very good thing, but there must be a place for everybody. And this objectification of have versus have not, of rich versus poor, of 99% versus the 1%, this actually isn't good. This is not a good thing, because the money issue is irrelevant. Money is ones and zeros. There's lots of it. There's tons of it. There's no shortage of money. There is a shortage of salmon, actually, on a global basis. In fact, their last stand is up there in Bristol Bay. And when we go in there to take out that fishery, the Bristol Bay salmon fishery, that's been there for tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of years. And we'll go in there, we'll take out the copper and the gold, and we'll get a lot of money, and the money will come and the money will go. And the fish are gone forever. And I'm concerned about the Chinese boy and girl 100 years from now, you know, that would like to see the beauty of a salmon run, because it is beautiful. It's an amazing life cycle that in 4 years, this little creature can go from being born in this tiny little egg, and a salmon can grow to like 125 pounds in 4 years. And it fights this noble fight swimming up this river, the river of its birth, and it surrenders itself and it surrenders its life for the next generation that will come before it. It's a sacrificial, beautiful, merciful act. And going in there and destroying the environment for the purposes of extracting metals out of the ground is just limited. It does not an expansiveness of consciousness, an expansiveness of love and compassion and kindness and goodness and all that. It's not in that direction. So we need to go in that other direction. These are things that we need to talk about. And some things need to be curtailed and stopped for all time.
What do you think are the fundamental economic changes after the dollar crashes?
Well, I don't know. I mean, for the dollar to crash, it would need to make a new price low. In recent years, the destabilization of Europe has led to a stronger dollar. So until the dollar actually breaks a new price low, which is, would be going back to 2008 levels, we cannot say that the dollar is going to crash. So when it breaks a new price low, likely this is something that we'll be participating from a trading standpoint, and we'll seek to profit from it. But we're not there yet.
But let's say it does happen. Mm-hmm. What do you think the what would be the outcomes of that? How would things change in the world order?
Well, as I said, I mean, I think what's coming in front of us is a rejection of all of that. What's coming in front of us is a rejection of all global governments. What's coming in front of us is a rejection of much of the world's religions. What's coming in front of us is a rejection of a lot of the coin of the realm. A lot of the coin of the realm of the world will be rejected, and there will be a new coin of the realm, and there will be a new global government infrastructure. And there will likely be a new global religion.
Those are interesting ideas.
The time has come.
Right.
The time has come for new ideas.
Right.
And the time has come even, and the time is even later that it is essential that these ideas are put forth, and it is essential that these ideas are implemented as soon as possible.
Well, the fact that you're putting these ideas even in this interview and also in your prior conversations and pieces in your books and in your blogs and so on, you're changing the fabric of conversation on this planet. So,
that's good.
So there's this question about economists paying attention to liquidity. What are your unique views on liquidity?
Liquidity. Well, liquidity is generated by participants. Participants need confidence. And then participants need understanding to participate. Liquidity is good. Participation is good. Commonality is good. Unity is good. A good market, a good one-world global marketplace of freely participating actors and characters and players and all humanity freely trading with everyone is good. But we have to let go of our fears. We have to let go of our distrust. And we have to respect differences. All of those differences will be sorted out in time anyway, you know, but we have to kind of expand our consciousness. If we can expand our consciousness and accept each other, then nothing needs to fight so hard to perpetuate itself. And the real value and the best practices and the best thoughts and ideas and the most enlightened thinking will prevail. But it's only when we fight things that they persist. So the best way to kind of lift a lot of the fog of thinking in people's minds on a global basis is to not fight their need to believe in things, but to allow them to believe in things. And when you allow someone to think, when they don't fight so hard to hold on to their beliefs because you've allowed them to do so. And then it's easier to begin to shape their minds and move them in a more productive, better way of thinking. But you cannot fight their need or their right to believe what they want, because it's in variety. Once again, it's very important. It's almost like if you had to create a new book, a new kind of a basis for all humanity to kind of circle around, that as something that we could all kind of embrace: individual freedom, individual right to believe, individual right to practice. This is beliefs and ideas. This is very, very important. So these are, we're moving in that direction now.
You know, in your book, you mentioned U.S. people are innovators, and even if there's no jobs, and U.S. entrepreneurs must create job opportunities for the U.S. What do you think are the key differences between U.S. entrepreneurs and their counterparts in emerging markets?
Well, it depends on which emerging markets you're talking about. I mean, the United States has at its foundation the original in the Constitution, the respect of liberty, of freedom, of the individual practice of religion, of all those types of things. This is a good thing. But we've created an institutional government that it, in and of itself, is no longer a solution or a defender of democracy, but it has now become an oppressive usurper of hope. It's kind of not very positive at all. And because the government in the West has become so large, it's, and the state governments under them, that their taxation and control of the entrepreneur is working against his desire to take risk and to expand their businesses or their ideas and their gifts and services that they might give to the world. So it's not good. Government itself is exploiting, over-exploiting the very citizenry that it supposedly was there to serve. Government should serve the people, and governments on a global basis are not serving the people. Governments on a global basis are perpetuating their own power structures. This is why they're all in the process of failing, and this is why they will fail.
And yet, even with, you know, the situation with governments globally, you still have innovation occurring, and in the U.S. continues to lead in innovation on a global basis. So there must be something there, some characteristic of maybe of Americans that just makes them more innovative.
Well, again, I think innovation, you're talking about creation, right? Innovation is creation. Innovation is, you know, is I come up with a new idea. I come up with a new concept, Starbucks, it was an innovation. McDonald's, believe it or not, at one point was an innovation. we could argue very, very concretely that McDonald's does not serve, well, it does serve the world. It just doesn't serve the world, I think, in a beneficial sense. But yeah, creation is a new idea, and the phone is a new idea, and the airplane is a new idea. A nuclear bomb is a new idea. These are an electric guitar, you know, is kind of a new idea. A drum is a new idea. A wheel is a new idea. So these are all very different things. And then you and I, we walk into the jungle, and we see different birds, or then there's the ocean, we see the dolphins, and the whales, and the tuna fish, and a sea urchin, and a starfish, and a seahorse, and a blue whale, and a little clownfish, like out of the movie Finding Nemo, and it's all variety. Variety is the very basis of creation. Variety is the natural state of the universe. It is the variance of the size and shape of planets. It is the variance in the size and shape of universes itself, whether it be the Milky Way or any other universes, and different stars and different planets and different ideas. And note, every person has different fingerprints. And so for innovation is for every one of us to be a force of creation. A lot of times people will say, I wish they would create something, or they ought to do that, or they ought to do something. That's a phrase that gets used a lot. They is you. There is no they. There's just you. There is no future. There's just now. And there's no past. There is just now. Have the courage. Have the confidence. Have the faith to be creative, and have a government, and a global government that at its very roots honors differences and honors the variety of thinking and practice and belief and thought. And when we have this in place on a global basis, we have a renaissance that may last thousands and thousands of years. And this planet and our culture and our global culture will take us beyond this planet, will take us into the stars, into the heavens, into the exploration of our universe, where untold things and possibilities lie before us. All of that is possible, and all of that will happen if we create the type of structure and global structure that I'm talking about. The possibility that none of that happening would be if we don't do the things that I'm talking about. I don't think that's going to happen, because I think actually that the former will happen. I do believe it is our destiny to expand into the stars and the heavens and other planets and all of those things. But we can search far and wide, and we can travel far, and I can go from here across town, or I can move to another town or another country, and yet wherever I go, there I will be. In another sense, we can think we're going to conquer the universe. To truly conquer the universe, we must conquer ourselves. And not so much a conquer ourselves, but to embrace our own compassion and to embrace the light in our hearts, and the light in our hearts that has the capacity, more importantly and firstly, to love ourselves. And then from that, to be able to expand that love to one another, and then and people, and to expand that love into our family, and then our town, and then our village, and then our country, and then the world equally. And then to simultaneously expand that love not only to people, but to all life. And when we do that, then we are ready.
You know, it's interesting, your thoughts on, I guess you would consider it a new world order. Perhaps really everything is coalescing to go into this sort of new world order. Do you see people under the pressure of financial crisis driving towards this new world order? And then what are your new concerns or main concerns if the world shifts in this way?
Well, I don't have concerns of it shifting in that way. It's my greatest hope that it does so, and that it does so with great haste. As for the financial crisis, it's not a financial crisis. The financial crisis is really a crisis of the spirit. We believe, mistakenly, that if we have one more television set, one more car, one more fancy handbag, one more thing, that we will fill the emptiness in our hearts and our souls. You cannot fill that emptiness with material things, because this is the material thing versus the spirit thing versus the soul versus the core of a person, which is essentially love and light and compassion and the essential goodness of all people. And so this is the thing that needs nourishing. And we cannot nourish that with things, because things are not eternal. Things are transient. Things come and go. If you do not believe this is so, simply observe the creation and destruction of things. Things come into being, they go out of being. A person is born, a person lives, a person dies. A form of music is popular, and then it is no longer popular. A belief is widely held, and then it is disregarded. All the nature of all life and of all things is change. And so, since it is change, for us to constantly invest ourselves into things that are impermanent, we're always constantly dissatisfied, because we know at our heart this is not why we're here. We're not transacting enough in compassion and kindness and love, and we transact in things and not in relationships. So we need to invest more in, as I said, the kind of opening of our hearts and compassion. And to the extent that we do this, then we feel more satisfied. And to the extent that we do this, there begins to be less of a financial crisis. But the financial crisis was essentially created by the assumption of debt. And why was the debt assumed so much? Well, the debt was assumed so much because we thought that things would satisfy us. And things are not satisfying. Again, as I said, because things are not, things come and go. Witness yourself, if you've ever bought something, you craved it and you wanted it, and then you got it. What did it feel like after you had it? It seems that there was more investment in the desire of that thing than the actual achievement and the attainment of possessing that thing. We do not need to possess more things, and we don't need not to possess more things. It simply has no meaning. It's not satisfying. It's like junk food. And junk food is not satisfying. I mean, if you don't believe so, sit down with a salted snack. Are you ever really satisfied? No, you just keep eating more. You keep eating, you keep eating, you keep eating, but you're not satisfied. There are particular business interests whose entire business model is based upon satisfying impulses. But impulses are just that. Impulses are impermanent. Impulses come and go. And this is your momentary desire for things. This is impulses. You have a desire for this today. And next week you have a desire for something else. And maybe that's manipulated by what you see on television or a newspaper or a magazine. And you crave and envy somebody else. All these are purposeless emotions. You cannot inevitably satisfy yourself this way. The only true satisfaction of any living thing is the relationship and the acceptance of itself and the greater acceptance of other. And when you can begin to dissolve that barrier between self and other, then comes the liberation of all people. And we just need to change what we're looking at and what we're looking for. And so the world is in a financial crisis because it was looking in the wrong, box. There's nothing in that box. The box that they need to look in is the box inside themselves, which is their heart, which is their compassion, which is their commonality, and the commonality one person has, an American has with a Chinese, an American has with a Russian to a Chinese, a Chinese to an African and to a dolphin and to a whale and to all things. It seems like a very big step, but one doesn't have to take all those steps at once, but it's important that the steps begin and that they begin now. This conversation that we're having is the beginning of that step and of the step that we shall all take together.
It's interesting that it's not a them, it's actually individually within each one of us as citizens of the world to, as you indicated, open our hearts and be perhaps more inclusive and diverse in our thinking. And that's going to change the world order. That's going to create the new world order. That's going to remove this idea of a financial crisis, which will require a behavioral shift in people on an individual basis and then on a collective basis globally.
Right.
And it's dialogues like that, like what's happening here today or in your writings, that will get people to start thinking about this shift in their behaviors and look at alternative ways and possibilities rather than the traditional, the cultural, the old way. And that will invoke some kind of change to a better world. That's kind of what you're saying, right?
I am saying that. Even more than that, as it takes practice. For what I'm talking about is a surrender of the self. That's a hard thing to do. It's coming.
You know, we have this sort of situation in Greece and Spain and other parts of the world, the economic situation that happened in the U.S. and even the sort of the ratings downgrade of the government due to the debt.
I think I want to just interrupt you for a second. I don't know if you've heard a little bit in the background here, but I'm kind of sensed that I'm a little emotionally affected by the things that we're talking about. And it's been my greatest desire from the time that I was a very young child, you know, 6 years old, 7 years old, to see the world that we're talking about today. And when I was very, very young, when I was that age, I kept on having these dreams. Really, every night I would have the same dream. And as a child, I couldn't quite understand them. But as I've become an adult, it's begun to have more clarity to me. The dreams that I had as a child was that the world would evolve in this way, that we would unite commonly. And the dreams that I had were massive gatherings of humanity at the same time. And I don't mean a couple of thousand, I mean millions, millions and millions.
Perhaps billions.
Yes.
And this kind of shared love and openness of heart and acceptance of all, including of nature itself, right? And so unification of all that is and will be.
Well, that was the dream.
And you're seeing elements of that already, right? And you're initiating a dialogue to move that world in action as well. You're supporting that effort through your thoughts and your words and through your messaging and through your interactions. And I know from research, because I have a research background, that every time any person, any entity interacts on a minute-by-minute, second-by-second basis, they themselves, their spirit, their brains are being remapped. They're being changed.
I know.
And that's all.
Well, it makes, it's very, when I think of it, it just really excites me, really fills my heart to think of a world that way, to think that the world could be that way. It's overwhelming. It's our greatest desire. It's our greatest hope. It's what we're all here for.
And it's your greatest wish when you were a child, because you saw this in your dreams and in your thoughts, and you're seeing this coalesce. And also in your sort of private studies that you've done, that goes beyond this world, and it's about, you know, nature and thinking and thought and spirit. I guess that sort of reinforces all of that mission that you've been on throughout your entire life.
I didn't put myself in those experiences. Some people say maybe you choose your parents or you choose all those things. Maybe I did. Maybe I didn't. I'm not conscious of that. but I'm here.
When we think about all of the things that are happening on this planet, and I was alluding to this earlier, this, you know, the crisis that happened in Greece and has continued to still happen, and in Spain, and you're even seeing elements of it in France, and the U.S. debt crisis, and in fact, I guess Congress has extended the time again, and you know, that's affected things like ratings around the world. What are your feelings about all of that economic stuff that's happening, the economic monitoring for governments, and what does that mean to the investor?
Well, I don't know. Every investor must take the pile of sticks they are given with and do the best they can to create something interesting. You have to kind of work with what's there. I think there are great companies. I think there are great businesses that exist in the world that are doing great things, that have great products, that have great services, great cultures, and great people. And we own those. And to the extent that we have any profit at all, our profit is derived from their good works. You know, an investor should seek to invest themselves in that. There's nothing we can do about this. We cannot affect, I cannot cause you to be different. I can only be a living example. So there's nothing we can do about Greece. There's nothing we can do about France. There's nothing, it's really, all of these things have to be dealt with from their internal problems. The world is where it is because of what exists internally. The debt crisis in Spain and Greece, the United States, this is all a manifestation. It's like it's not the cause of the problem. It's the result of the problem. The problem is deeper than all of that. But meanwhile, as an investor, there are good businesses, there are good companies to own and invest, and you invest in them, and you're a shareholder in them, and they expand. They're benefiting from change, and you place capital, you invest money in the path of that change. And you just, you know, and you have the flow of business and the flow of sales and earnings into the companies that you invest in, driven by change in society. And that's, change in society has always driven and always been, the creator of the best performing companies and business on a global basis and will always be. What you need to be is kind of perceptive enough, have eyes open enough to see change. But seeing that change, once again, has to have that state of mind that is open to seeing change. And so then that's surrendering yourself a little, once again. You have to be able to not project your biases because you can't see much. You already have ideas in your head. A lot of times you have to empty your ideas in your head and simply be like a blank piece of paper.
I guess that's difficult for a lot of people because really, in essence, people are living in a virtual world based on their biases and their filters. And really, what is the real world compared to what they're perceiving within themselves? It's always some kind of augmented reality of what's really out there.
People have biases, they have beliefs, they have identities, and they have egos because they're afraid of being naked. They're afraid of being that naked, pure, you know, light. You know, that they're essentially the essential element of all life, of all things, is the commonality of love, of goodness, of kindness, of openness, of no fear, of a lack of fear. We have this need to give ourselves identities and beliefs and viewpoints and all this type of stuff because of our essential fear of surrender. And we pursue it mistakenly. But if we can let go of those things, if we can let go and surrender a lot of that, then ironically enough, we get what we're all working so hard for, which is security. In the pursuit of security because of our fear, we have created a world of insecurity. Because essentially, most human beings are insecure. That's why they put so much work into identity and protection and things, because they think things have permanence, and things don't have permanence. It's only the spirit that has permanence.
So have you sort of aligned some of your thinking with or read some of the works of Eckhart Tolle and, you know, The Power of Now and The New Earth and things like that, where you're kind of living in the now?
No, I've not read Eckhart Tolle.
Right. It's interesting. There's sort of some similarities in some of the ideas, right? So, Damon, we're down to our last couple of questions, and this next one is kind of to mine all of the experiences you have. You've done speaking, and you've traveled broadly, and your work is known worldwide, you know, and you're a deep thinker. You're very philosophical as well. Is there any short stories you want to share, maybe something surprising, unexpected, amazing, or amusing?
No.
Well, that was a quick one.
I have no clever short stories. Well, one, this interview has certainly been interesting. I really had no expectations of it, which is good. And, you know, I think that was the beauty of it. And my final words would be that I love you.
Well, that's interesting. And I could say that I love you as well. I mean, I care for all of humanity, right? So, and as individuals. I do have one final question, and this is where I just open it up to you. And you know, we've had this great discussion, this interchange, and some of it business related, some of it philosophical, some of which is to change individuals on the planet and their mindset. So if you were conducting this interview, what maybe one, two, three questions would you have asked? And then what would be your answers? So I'm kind of turning the table. In other words, what have I missed that you would have wanted me to ask you? And then what would be your answers?
Oh, that's amazing. No, I don't have anything there. The interview, I think, went extremely well. You know, talking about these types of things is hard work. It is the frontier. It really is. The frontier is the human heart. And to the extent that we make peace with that, anything that we can conceive is possible, and possible right in front of us. But it starts there. It starts with putting that key into the lock. Good.
Well, I want to thank you for coming in today. I know your schedule is demanding, so, you know, we're really fortunate to have you share your insights with our audience. So thank you so much.
Thank you very much. It was a great time, and thanks for having me on.
I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and this concludes our exclusive interview with Damon Vickers, Chief Investment Officer, world-renowned investment authority, best-selling author, The Day After Dollar Crashes.